Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest set of adventures, the latest intrigue from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie and Jones. And, Miss Jones, how are we this fine day?
Absolutely brilliant, Mr. Parry. Thank you. Yes. I feel like I'm firing on all fours today. There have been quite a lot of deaths. All fours, yeah. No. A lot of deaths lately, and I've got quite a few funerals coming up, unfortunately.
Oh, my God.
I feel like it's given me a new lease of life, is what I'm trying to say.
The people around you are dropping like flies.
Not because of that, but it's woken me up to better make the most of it, because you never know how long you've got left.
Well, no, I suppose there's something to be said for that. That's one of the big problems in life, of course, isn't it? You know, what do we do with our resources for the rest of our life? Because we don't know how long we're going to live. You know what I mean? Funnily enough, I've had meetings with my accountants in the last week or so, and it's very forward-looking. You know, should the political situation change, how will that affect your money and all this kind of stuff? It's very good. It's a great service, you know, and should we, you know, put money in this or that or whatever. But then you think, I've only got a finite amount of money. What's going to happen if I live till I'm 92? You know what I mean? And that worries me a bit. I don't know about you.
I had this very conversation with a friend of mine on Sunday over lunch. She's a hedge fund manager.
Oh, right.
And Japanese-American friend of mine. Yeah. And she was saying, the one flaw in human life is that we don't know when we're going to die.
No.
If only we could know exactly when, we could plan the rest of our lives really brilliantly, decide about the money and property and all that kind of thing, and then we could know what we've got in store.
Yeah.
You know, if only we could find out the date.
Well, I think that, you know, probably in decades to come, we're going to have to come to a deal where when we're aged something like 40, I was going to say 21, but that's too young, 40, you then have to sign the equivalent of your own death sentence and tell somebody how long you're going to live. And if you say 75, then on your 75th birthday, you walk through a door and you don't come back. You know what I mean? Otherwise, the world's going to get overpopulated.
There is this thing that they used to do in Japan. I don't know whether it still happens, and I need to ask my friend about it. But it was among peasant people, Japanese peasant people, so very poor people, who couldn't afford to look after their elderly.
Oh, right.
And the story was that they would take them to the forest and lead them into the forest, and they would leave these old people there. At the mercy of the elements, wild animals, whatever else.
Yes.
But it was sort of part of the culture that this is what would happen
when
they became too frail and old.
Well, Native Americans, as we call them these days. When I was a kid, we used to call them cowboys and Indians, but we don't. We call them Native Americans now. And I'm quite interested in their history. You know, I mean, that was the worst crime in humanity, wasn't it, in terms of a race of people who had their country taken away from them. The Native Americans were just getting on with life, you know, living in their tepees and, you know, looking after nature and the world. And then suddenly, you know, the invaders came and wiped them out. But they had a system where when the elders got too old and it was too much trouble to look after them, they took them into a forest, like you say, usually in the height of winter when it was about minus 20, and they just left them there.
It's very cruel if you think about it, but it's part of nature.
Yes.
I suppose this is how the animal kingdom deals
with
things.
That's right,
It is harsh when those people have given you life in the first place.
Yes, that's right. But it's like
and the idea of not nurturing your parents or your grandparents is very alien in our society. Isn't
it is. I agree. But to the Native Americans, it was just the normal cycle of life, as you quite rightly say. And they would next day see an eagle or something, and they would think that that eagle was actually, you know, the elder that they'd abandoned in the forest or something like that. But anyway, look.
I suppose that's quite a simplistic way of, justifying what you've just done, isn't
it? I suppose so. Anyway, a bit of a maudlin subject, so let's move on.
Yeah, it is a bit. Moving on.
Moving on. Well, actually, funny enough, we're going to talk about somebody who has died, and it's the former editor of the Observer, Donald Trelford. Now, did you ever come across him?
Once I met him. I can't remember where or why. He was editor of the Observer, wasn't he?
Oh, for about 30 years. I mean,
yeah. So, you know, about not our generation, much older than us, but I'm sure I met him with my father. Mm. He was, wasn't he very, very small?
Yes.
Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Yes, he was about 5'2" or 5'3" or something. Yes.
Yeah, he was quite gnome-like and not very attractive. And I remember
You're wrong. He was an incredible womanizer.
Yeah, he was a womanizer, but he was ugly.
Was he? Oh, I didn't know he was. I met him a couple of times. He and Andrew Neil, editor of the Sunday Times, used to sort of compete with each other in London nightlife. They were always turning up at Annabelle's and places like that. You know what I mean?
Tramp and stuff. Yeah. But the interesting thing there was that Andrew Neil was a bachelor, wasn't he? He was a kind of debonair man about town. Footloose and fancy free, never committed to any women.
Yeah.
But Donald Trelford was married.
He was. You're absolutely right. He married 3 times in all. And his last wife was 25 years younger than him. And they retired to like a villa in Mallorca. He had quite an idyllic end to his life, you know, but it was
not very idyllic for his wife. He's left with very, very young children and no father.
You could be right there. I think the youngest child's about 13 or something. But anyway, look, that's his private life. The point is, I knew him in Fleet Street for one particular scandal, and it was over a lady called Pamela Bordes, right? And this,
I do remember this.
Yeah, and the whole of Fleet Street was chasing Pamela Bordes because. I think she first met Andrew Neil in, as you say, Tramp or Annabelle's or something like that, when she walked up to him and told him what an attractive man he was. And, of course, Andrew Neil's got quite an ego. And he thought, and she's a former Miss India, by the way. That's how good-looking Pamela Bordes was. I mean, stunningly attractive and good-looking woman. But it suddenly transpired, you know, all sorts of allegations started coming out about Ms. Bordes, whether she was mixing with, you know, spies and all this kind of stuff and, you know, her former life and what she'd got up to. And it ended up with Fleet Street reporters chasing her all around the world to find out what she was all about. And variously, I think she was the girlfriend of, certainly of Andrew Neil, but also maybe Donald Trelford. I think she was the one who revealed that Andrew Neil rubbed sort of this coconut oil or something in his hair to try and restore growth, you know, where his hair was going thin. And seriously.
I remember I was on the Mail at the time.
Yes.
The Daily Mail. Yeah. And Linda Lee Potter, the Mail got the story. They got the exclusive with her.
Yeah. Oh, right.
And Linda Lee Potter got to spend 2 weeks with Pamela Bordes, as she called herself.
Yeah.
We found out subsequently that she was really born plain Pamela Singh, and she'd sort of worked her way up.
Yeah.
And she said herself, this is Pamela Bordes talking,
yeah,
I like to get a photograph of the man I'm interested in and look at it to find the man within. Then I look them up in Who's Who.
Mm.
And I research their interests. And if he rides, I ride. If he shoots, I shoot. And Linda Lee Potter said, when she ran her exclusive, over 2 weeks, by the way, she called her sickeningly self-obsessed, utterly immoral, and unashamedly amoral, a greedy, grubby call girl selling her sexual favours. And, of course, it was Adnan Khashoggi who had employed her as one of his call girls in his sex ring. That's how she started out, and she got ideas above her station and decided to target these very influential Brits who would be her passport into British high society. That was the plan, but it all came off the rails because she started playing them off against each other. And then she was flying to Paris and having sort of assignations with spies and so on. And it all became a threat to national security.
It was amazing, wasn't it? Yeah. I remember dispatching like 4 reporters one night to go to all the nightclubs in London and find Pamela Bordes, you know what I mean, for one particular reason or another. And they were kind of exciting times. But anyway, and
I think somebody said this. Oh, she was in with Gaddafi, by the way. She was meeting intelligence officers of Colonel Gaddafi's. I mean, that is a threat to national security, isn't it, really?
Oh, yeah,
But it turned out, and it sort of succinctly boiled down to the fact that her trick was making truly ugly men believe that they were wildly attractive. And I just laughed so much when I read that, because that's what so many women do.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sorry. You know, I've still got a lot of respect for Andrew Neil, so it's a bit harsh to brand Andrew Neil within that. Although I always found Andrew Neil actually took the mickey out of himself a bit, you know what I mean? I remember when he was editor of the Sunday Times and I was working at Wapping, and you'd see him flounce around. I think he invented the idea of wearing braces over his shirt and all that kind of stuff. You're absolutely right. He did fancy himself as a dandy about town. Yes, no doubt.
Yeah, he did. But he must feel ridiculous now when he thinks back to those years and how he was taken for a chump.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that. But when you've got an ego like that, you can't actually see yourself in a mirror. You know, you can't see how ridiculous you are, can you?
I suppose that's what Robbie Burns meant when he said along the lines of, and I won't do the Scottish, the Gaelic version of it, but would the power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us.
Yes, that's a very good line, that. Well done. Now then, sorry, I don't know why we're talking about dead people all the time, but...
because they died.
Yeah, that's because they died. But, of course, you are a warden at St Bride's, and am I right in thinking that it was Charlie Wilson's memorial recently, Charlie Wilson, the former editor of the Times?
Yes, that was last week.
That was last week.
He was a nice man. I remember him. I never met him, actually. But I remember he was married to Anne Robinson, who was a colleague of my dad's at the Mirror.
Yeah.
And he was MD of the Mirror Group, wasn't he, in the 90s? And
yeah, he was, yeah.
He was also briefly, he was the editor of The Independent, where my dad ended up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I was aware of him, but I never actually met him.
He only ever sacked 3 people when he was editor of The Times, and one of them was Mr. Boris Johnson, who was writing the column for The Times. And Charlie.
Good man.
Yeah, Charlie good found man. Out he made something up, allegedly, and so he got the buzz. Now, from the dead people to somebody who's alive, Buzz Aldrin. Now, I was going to talk to you about Buzz Aldrin last week.
Just about alive.
Yeah, just about alive. You're absolutely right. And for some unknown reason, I strayed off into some territory and lost my concentration. But the reason I wanted to talk to you about Buzz Aldrin is at 91, I think he's just got married again, hasn't he? Or he's certainly got a new girlfriend. Anyways,
he has somebody who's about 50 years younger than him.
That's right. But
I think it's Henry Kissinger syndrome all over again, isn't it? Which is that you can be as ugly as sin, as interesting as a vacant walnut shell, but if you are if you've gone to the moon, if you wield power and influence and have money, crucially, you can have any woman of a certain kind that you may want.
Yeah, well, you may well be right. But I read a column by Jeremy Clarkson a couple of days after this picture appeared, okay? And
he's still going then.
Who, Jeremy Clarkson?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't write a column. He normally writes for 3 or 4 weeks after the controversy about Meghan, you know, and all that. But his columns are appearing quite regularly now. But what I was going to say was, Clarkson pointed out that one time he was doing some TV show and the star guest was Buzz Aldrin, or he was one of the guests anyway. And just seconds before the light went on and they went live to air, Aldrin leaned over and said to the producer, "I ain't talking about the moon."
What do you think you're here for, man?
Yeah, exactly. Do you remember when Boris Johnson's wife, was it Marion? What was her name? You know.
It was something beginning with that. Marina.
Well, she, after they split, you know, about a year later, she wrote a book about something. And, of course.
Not about Boris.
Well, she got invited onto all the chat shows, TV shows, all that kind of stuff. And everyone, this is great. But they were all disappointed because every time she got into the studio, she said, "Oh, by the way, the one thing I'm not talking about is Boris Johnson," which was, of course, the very point of inviting her in the first place. A book was about something else. A book was about saving the world or something. You know what I mean? But do you remember one time, you may know about, you won't remember it because you were too young, but you may know about this from me. But one time, John and Yoko Lennon were being interviewed on a TV show. I think it was in America, okay? And it was, you know, some, you know, TV, late TV, night TV show. And I think John might have been under the influence of something. He went through a period when he was a heroin addict, didn't he?
He did, yes. And she did as well.
And she did as well. So the interviewer said, you know, asked him something about the Beatles. Because, I mean, if you're interviewing John Lennon, you would ask him about the Beatles, wouldn't you?
And he, well, you try and get away with it, yeah.
That's right, yeah. And he said, no, I'm not talking about the Beatles. Don't ask me about the Beatles. I'm not talking about it. And, you know, the interviewer then said, John, I have to. You know, you're a member of the most famous group in the history of pop music. He said, I've told you, don't ask me about the Beatles. If you ask me about the Beatles, I'm going in the bag. And the interviewer said, I'm sorry, what do you mean, going in the bag? He said, I'm going in the bag. I'm into bagism. Bring on the bag. And somebody brought a bag on, and he got into this bag, and that's where bagism started with John Lennon.
Very funny, isn't it, now?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose we'd have to employ the Columbo technique at that point, wouldn't we? So if so, you remember this, if somebody told us that we could go and interview someone famous, but we were not allowed to bring up a certain subject.
That's right.
You wouldn't bring it up. You'd sit there with them for the allotted hour,
yeah.
And then you would thank them very much. Mm. You'd put away everything. You'd go to the door, and you'd open the door, and you'd look back, and you'd say, just one thing.
That's right, yeah. Just.
And if they then lost their temper or created a scene in some way, yeah. There was your intro.
Yes, absolutely. No, I totally agree. You got your tactics absolutely right, Miss Jones. Talking about the Beatles, of course, wasn't it 40 years ago this week that the Savile Row concert took place?
54 years, in fact.
Why did I say
54 years on the roof. Yeah. I sort of feel, I was a bit lukewarm about this. I was invited up to Savile Row to go and, you know, mark the occasion.
Were you?
Somebody was up there making a film,
fantastic.
Yeah. And I sort of thought, well, haven't we done this now?
Mm.
It's so familiar to us. We've watched the film so many times.
Yes.
We know what happened. We know the songs backwards. Doesn't there come a point when you sort of leave it?
Yeah, well, yes, but it was such an historic, momentous event in the history of pop music, wasn't it? And
Yeah, of course. I can see why younger people who may not have come across it before, visiting tourists, Americans, Japanese in particular, you know, why they would want to go there and have a look. Because it's a shop now, by the way. The premises, 3 Savile Row,
right.
It's a shop. It was Abercrombie & Fitch last time I looked.
Oh, right.
It could well be something else now.
Yeah.
But you can go in the shop, but there's nothing there that says this was the Beatles HQ.
Right.
There's a plaque on the wall outside.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go up to the roof, but you can stand across the street and sort of look up and vaguely imagine it as it once was.
Golly,
but
yeah.
I see its point as a tourist attraction. But for me, I sort of feel like we've done that.
Yeah.
We've been there.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, I was doing radio late night shows, and the guy I used to keep phoning in was Steve Lillywhite. The guy who produced the U2.
U2.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he lived in Thailand. I'm not sure if he still does, but he's just a regular listener to the show, you know, worldwide on the computer and all that kind of stuff. And then he came to England and we met him. And the one thing he told me, which I remember so distinctly, was that U2, people may not remember this, but I do, U2 tried to imitate the Beatles by doing exactly the same in Los Angeles, and they played on the roof of a warehouse or something, singing Where the Streets Have No Name. Do you remember it?
Vaguely. I've got a vague recollection.
Yeah, old Bono standing at the front there, and Edge, you know, the guitarist sitting on a brick wall and playing. And my phone's ringing. Sorry about that. I'll switch it off. And hang on. There we go. Thank you very much. And he said, no, we're just a pure imitation. And exactly the same effect happened, of course. Thousands of people gathered, and they had to call in fire engines and, you know, put ladders up to the roof to get it to stop and all that kind of stuff. But there you go. Once again, the point I'm making is that it was the Beatles who invented it, and then people have been trying to copy it ever since. Now, Miss Jones, I have a problem here about my credibility. You may or may not have read that ITV are going to bring out a Love Island for the Middle-Aged programme. Have you read this?
I have read this. Yeah. Read quite a lot about this, actually.
Right, excellent. And it's heavily thought or tipped, or might even be certain now, that Davina McCall is going to be the host of this Love Island for the middle-aged, right?
Well, Ulrika Johnson might argue with you over that, because she's angling for the job as well.
Ooh, well, I think Davina might be a stride or two ahead from what I've been reading. Anyway, point of my story is that the only way you can get in on this is if your adult children nominate you. So you, Miss Jones, are in pole position. You could get one of your three adult children to nominate you, and whoosh, you'll be off to Love Island.
Can I tell you now, there is no way I would get my bits out on such a programme for the titillation of the nation.
Yes.
Nobody is that desperate.
I don't think you'd have to get your bits out. I think it'd be a bit more modest than that, as people are middle-aged.
Well, they expect you to put on a bikini and sit around a pool and strut your stuff and all that kind of thing. Yeah. I can think of nothing more gross. Nobody needs to see that.
Yes. Yeah, well, OK, you say that. Now, I've got the opposite point of view. I think I would be the star of that show, okay? In fact,
I think you probably would, actually, well, thinking about it.
There you go. You know, I'd be the star of that show. I'd be, you know, erudite and witty and informative and all that kind of stuff.
And you would actually strip off?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have no...
Down to your shorts?
Well, I, you know, if I were to go swimming these days, you wear long baggy shorts, you know, so it's not a problem. And I would always wear some kind of short sleeve shirt, because the sun gets me if I don't. So I'd be quite well covered up for medical reasons. Now, the problem is that I...
Medical reasons, yeah.
Yes, medical reasons, yeah.
Yeah. It's different for women, because they would expect you to flash the flesh. They would expect you in a bikini, yeah, or a sort of cheeky revealing one piece.
Right.
You know, but the fact is, most women at this stage in the game have had children.
Mm.
And, you know, childbirth and time are not very kind to, yeah, middle-aged ladies who've been through those processes.
Yes.
So
yes.
I don't really want to look at that, to be honest. I certainly wouldn't want to get it out.
No. Well, Miss Jones, you know, family show and all that. But but no, I think I'd be good. So what I've done is I've started my one-man campaign to get the rules changed, okay? So,
because you haven't got kids to nominate you.
Yes, but I've got a niece, you see. And I was talking to my niece about this last weekend. And I said, look, you're going to have to nominate me. I'm going to start a campaign to try and get the rules changed so that even though I don't have children, I have a niece, I can get nominated by my niece. I think that's very fair, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yes,
I think we shouldn't discriminate against the childless.
I totally agree. So I put this idea out yesterday on Twitter, and lo and behold, Ms. McCall, who's got 2.7 million Twitter followers, suddenly picks up on it and, you know, gave me a response, a sort of, hi, Mike, or something like that, you know, be good to, you know what's going on, or something like that. And, of course, that has started a bit of a rumble. So I intend to pick it up from here. So, Miss Jones, you in your very wide show business circles, I'm depending upon you to spread the word.
I shall certainly do that for you, Mike. I shall champion your cause.
Yes, good.
And I look forward with great glee, yes, to seeing you on the show.
Oh, yeah, I think I should be. Really, I should. I mean, look at the life I've led. Look at the funny stories I could tell. Look at the way I could impress everybody, you know, with my brilliance and you know, my tales of adventures around the world. It's
your witty back chat, Michael.
Witty back chat. I mean, honestly, this stage is made for me.
But, yes, you do understand the whole thrust of the show. I use the word advisedly.
Yes, please do use it advisedly, Miss Jones, yes?
Which is to pair you up with someone, because, yeah, that has to be the culmination of the programme.
Well, also,
so you have actually said in the past that you're not interested in meeting a woman anymore.
Well, you know, I can always...
In the interests of research and science, you might change your mind.
In the interests of research, science, and a big fat check, okay, you know, because I hope I'll get paid loads of money.
There is the rub.
Yeah, that's right. All I can say is there's one lucky woman out there somewhere who doesn't know how lucky she's going to be. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on, I was going to say Love Island then for a minute.
What programme are we doing here?
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
What's my name?
Yeah, that's right, on Planet Porky. Mrs. Jones and I have just been discussing the merits of getting off to Love Island, of course, for the middle-aged, and I'm now involved in the campaign to change the rules, as I've just reminded you all. Now then, Mrs. Jones, you will be aware that last week Rod Stewart was in the news, this week, I think, wasn't it? Last week, in the news, because he phoned in to a Sky TV show being held by my old friend Sarah Jane Mee. So it's the afternoon show on Sky. I've done...
Yeah, we like Sarah Jane. Yes. She's sweet, isn't
yes,
she?
Yes, that's right. I've done a lot of shows with her.
She's a good journalist. Yeah, she's very, very competent.
Yeah, she used to do the breakfast show and we used to do the paper reviews and that kind of stuff, you know, but very nice lady. And suddenly Rod rings in to talk about the state of the health service. He's going to pay for scans for people to have that they can't get on the National Health Service. And doesn't surprise me, very decent chap, old Rod. And but then perhaps a little more surprisingly, although obviously it's a free country, Rod then announced that having been a Conservative, he now feels it's time for them to step aside and give Labour a chance. I thought that was quite a dramatic intervention because, mostly speaking, pop stars don't always nail their colours to the mast like that, do they?
No, they don't. I think there's a bit of guilt going on with Rod, to be honest. Mm. It's easy to forget that he became a tax exile in the 1970s and moved to Los Angeles in 75, actually, yeah. To avoid the 83% tax on top earners that was in place at that time.
So the south of France as well.
They did go to the south of France, and I think this might be atonement on Rod's part for having abandoned ship.
Oh, well.
50 years ago, I suppose he's hoping that no one remembers.
Yeah, but he's lived in this country on and off for the last 40 years, hasn't he? Since the Thatcher days when taxes were pared back amazingly. I think when Mrs. Thatcher got in, I think the top rate of tax was something like 92p or something, and she cut back the top rate to 40p for everybody, so everybody came back then.
Yeah, I think that's true. But yeah, I don't know. Is it really helpful for somebody like him to say, go on then, I'll pay, this was a weird thing as well that he said,
yeah,
I'll pay for 10 or 20 scans.
Yes, that's right.
10 or 20, that's a bit nebulous, isn't it? But is that really going to help in the grand scheme?
Well, yeah, but I think it's indicative of the fact that he's, you know, a decent chap. Now, one of the reasons I'm telling you this story is because I was doing my radio show on TalkSport one morning, and I think it must have been a Monday morning, when all of a sudden the producer came in and said, you know that item you've just done about Rod Stewart's house? Because it was one of these things where the paper had got hold of the estate agent's pictures of Rod's house because it was up for sale, okay? And, of course, they showed the inside of the house. And then a diarist, I think on the Daily Mail, but it might have been another paper, was mocking the chintzy furniture, you know, saying it all, you know, very twee and all that kind of stuff. So I made a comment on the show saying, you know, I think it's completely out of order for a newspaper diarist to get hold of the picture of the inside of Rod Stewart's house and then start mocking it because it's old-fashioned and chintzy and all that kind of stuff. And so I was supporting Rod. Anyway, the producer came in and said, there's a bloke who's just rung in, says he's Rod Stewart, wants to thank you for sticking up for him with that feature about his house. I said, well, you've got to make sure it's him. Go and ask him. They said, well, he said, we think it's him. I said, well, look, he's a big Celtic fan. Go and ask him to name the Celtic team that won Britain's first European Cup in 1967.
So, oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Just off the top of your head.
Yeah, well, I mean, for instance, I could name the Everton team that won the FA Cup in 1966, right? Because when you're such a lifelong fan of a team, you can always remember the legendary teams, you see what I mean?
So yeah, I do.
Yeah. So anyway, he went out, he came back, he said, yeah, you got it absolutely right. We think it is Rod Stewart. I said, right, put him through. So he came on and he said, thanks, boys. Very good of you. I love Talk Sport. Always listen to it. Big football fan. And then we talked a bit about Celtic and, you know, talked a bit about the England team and all that. And it was very amiable. He said, yeah, anytime, fellas, anytime. Always love listening to you. And off he went. About a week later, I got a call from a PR lady in London, you know, oh, hello, Mr. Parry. I said, yes. She said, oh, I'm from, you know, so-and-so PR. I said, right. And she said, I've been asked to invite you to the Scottish FA Cup semi-final at Hampden Park. this coming Saturday. I think it was Celtic Rangers, but it might not have been. She said, in the company of Rod Stewart. I said, oh, I said, well, that's really very nice. Thank you very much indeed. And please thank Sir Rod for, I think he was Sir Rod then, for, you know, the invitation. But I wasn't actually planning to be in Glasgow on, I think it was Sunday, actually. I wasn't actually planning to be in Glasgow on Sunday to get to Hampden Park. She said, oh, no. You go with Rod on his plane from Stansted. Oh, I said, I see. Right, okay. So we went on his private jet from Stansted to Glasgow and watched the game, came back. It was just a lovely experience, honestly.
And your carbon footprint went through the roof.
Well, probably, but, you know, he's terribly generous like that. My friend Alan Brazil's done the same sort of thing, you know, and he's just, honestly, a very decent guy. In fact, Piers wrote in his column, didn't he, this week, because Piers has met him a couple of times and said what a damn decent chap he is. And he is, you know, because a lot of these people are so removed from the real world. I'll tell you the funny story to talk about the real world. And he asked me not to talk about it on the radio at the time, but it's a few years back now, so I think it'll be okay. After the game, we went to a shop that sold trainers. Which one would that be? Like JD Sports or something like that. You know what I mean? And it's a big one in Glasgow because one of the boys was getting a new pair of trainers. But Rod had been given strict instructions by his wife, Penny Lancaster, mother of his two youngest boys, not to pay more than £150 for the trainers. And they'd actually turned out to be more expensive. So everybody was sworn to secrecy. Don't talk about the price of the trainers. Now, considering that his last evaluation in the Sunday Times Ritualist was about 130 million quid, I mean, that's quite grounding, isn't it?
As if Penny couldn't find out.
Well, you know, I think it was just sort of to keep within the letter of the law, so to speak. I mean, look, I think it was quite... It's quite commendable that she's trying to keep her boys grounded and make sure they don't get spoilt and all that. That's a good thing for a mother, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. The bit I don't get, and I know it's an admirable thing for her to have done, training and qualifying as a police officer, but if your husband is a rock superstar, international, fated, you know, 130 million quid in the bank, blah, blah.
And one of the most famous men in the world, yeah.
One of the most famous men in the world. How does that chime with you going out on the beat and acting as an... You know, any old police officer. I don't mean to be insulting police officers.
Yes.
But how does that work exactly?
Yes.
Is that not a contradiction in terms?
Well, I understand where you're coming from, but I still think it's very commendable for her to get down to literally the grassroots levels of walking the streets. And I don't think she gets any special attention. It's not like they say, right, it's Penny Lancaster, we'll have to send two bodyguards with her. I mean, she does genuinely, you know, go out on the beat anonymously, because when she's got her hair tied back, she's got a hat on and, you know, she's got a police uniform on, people aren't looking at Penny Lancaster, they're looking at a special constable. And I admire her enormously for it. She's also, isn't she a spokeswoman for some woman's rights movement or something? I saw her on the telly the other day.
Possibly, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's...
Doesn't it make her a target, Mike? I think, you know, I hear what you're saying. She ties her hair up.
Yeah.
She puts a hat on. Mm. She's still recognisable. And the reason she is that she's talked about it in the press. So people are expecting to see her.
Mm. Mm. Well, okay, you know.
If it were anonymous, I could understand it.
Yeah, well.
You know, if you're the wife of an international superstar and you want to go and do this out of the goodness of your heart because you want to do something altruistic for society and not because of who he is, you just keep quiet about it. You don't make it a focal point of interviews.
Yeah, well, yes, but because of the level of fame, which you've just, you know, illustrated, somebody was always going to find out that she'd become a special constable. She did a programme, didn't she, going out with the police, and then thought it was so interesting, she thought she'd join herself. So I admire her for it, honestly, I really do. And And the way
I'm not saying I don't admire her, sure, but I'm saying it's a very risky thing to do. She's a kidnap risk.
Well,
as are their children.
Yes, but they don't advertise, oh, right, tonight Penny Lancaster will be walking around the City of London in Bishopsgate and all that, you know. So anyway, look, I hear where you're coming from. Now, is one of the most ridiculous journalistic stunts you and I have ever come across that picture of two people in a bath in Ghislaine Maxwell's home to try and wearing a mask of Prince Andrew, the other wearing a mask of Virginia Giuffre or Virginia Roberts, as she was then, to try and illustrate that two people couldn't have sexual activity in a bath. But in fact, all they illustrated was that you can get two people in a bath. I mean, and what was it doing on the front of the Daily Telegraph, a respectable, sober newspaper? I couldn't work it out, could you?
I actually checked the date to see whether it was April the 1st.
Exactly.
Because I thought this has to be a stunt. This has to be a joke. This can't be a for real news story, can it?
No,
but it was.
I totally agree. I thought, what on earth is all this about? It's somebody who's trying to protect Prince Andrew has photographed a stunt which was meant to once and for all prove that he couldn't have had sexual activity with her in that little bath because it was too small. A, it didn't prove that at all. It proved two people could get in the bath. But B, it was just a pointless exercise. And a few days later, of course, the Mail on Sunday came out with a definitive story proving that the original picture of Andrew with his hand around the young Virginia Roberts was in fact very genuine and tracked down by probably an old colleague of yours, Sharon Churcher.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because on Saturday evening, the first edition of the Mail on Sunday dropped with a splash.
Yeah.
And it was an interview with a photographer, the photographer, who'd gone with Sharon Churcher to Australia. Mm. They tracked down Virginia Giuffre Roberts, whatever she was called at that particular time. Yeah. And she brought out a folder and produced the actual print of that picture of Andrew, Virginia, and Ghislaine Maxwell in the background.
Yes.
That Andrew has since said there is no original print. Well, there is, and she has it.
Yeah.
And this photographer took a picture. He took about 30 pictures, actually. They call them pickups, don't they, in our business?
Yes.
Where you take a picture of a photograph. Right. And he also, crucially, flipped it over and he took photographs of the back of the picture, which very clearly shows the processing date of the photograph and where it was processed.
Yes.
In Florida, which was a processing shop about 2 minutes from where she was living at the time.
Yes.
But then that story disappeared overnight. And when I looked the next day at the last edition of the Mail on Sunday, it had disappeared completely. So what went on there?
Well, I don't know, because it was still in the Mail on Sunday, because I got a late edition, because I get mine on Sunday morning, you know, but they come from Greater London. And it was still on the inside. They just, what did they lead their story on? Can you remember? They lead the paper on.
I don't remember, but they downgraded the story because that is a major world exclusive.
Oh,
they downgraded it. So I suspect that there was some sort of legal challenge in the meantime.
Well, it might have just been a proprietorial, you know what I mean? It might have been the chairman of the company just thought, no, I don't want it on the front and had a quick word
with
the editor or something like that, you know.
But so Andrew came out a couple of weeks ago and he said, within the month, there will be a major revelation that will prove my innocence.
Yeah.
What on earth is that?
Well, it must have been the bath stunt, I suppose, because, you know, it couldn't be anything else. It can't be anything else.
No, he's still saying it.
Oh, is
it? There is going to be a major revelation that will prove his innocence.
Yeah, but remember, we've also, I mean, this story gets so long and complicated. Alan Dershowitz, who is a celebrity lawyer in America, has represented everybody from Mike Tyson to, I think, Donald Trump. You know what I mean? He was
so a very savory kind of guy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was accused of something by some woman who since has
It was Virginia Giuffre. It was her.
Yeah, it was her. Yeah.
Yeah. She said that he forced her to have sex with him. She then withdrew it.
Yes, that's right.
Pardon the non-Family Show pun.
Yes, exactly.
And said that she must have made a mistake.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Well, maybe Andrew's now relying on that to try for the knock-on effect of, so she must have made a mistake with me. I don't know.
Okay.
But but anyway, look, too much legalese, Miss Jones, too much legalese. Let's talk about a very, very serious issue. Gen Z in pint snob. Almost one in four adults under 30 have never drunk a pint of beer. One in eight Gen Zs say it is what their granddads enjoy in the pubs and won't touch it. But one in four have never drunk a pint of beer. I mean, honestly, I feel for young people if they've got to the age of 21 and never drunk a pint of beer or cider or lager. There's something dreadfully wrong with our young people.
No, my kids are Gen Zs, as they call them, and they don't drink beer. My son will occasionally have a lager. Yeah. They don't drink cider. They're not interested in anything like that. Yeah. I offered them a black velvet at my place not long ago, and they turned their nose up at that, which, of course, is Guinness and champagne or Prosecco, whatever you want to make it with. They drink wine and whiskey. That's what they drink nowadays.
Really? Golly. Yeah. Well,
and they're not interested in draft beers at all. That's just not what they're into.
Well, I find that remarkable. I mean, for me, there's nothing better than, you know, a frothing pint of ale. You know what I mean? That's why I went into pubs in the first place. That's why I still go into pubs today. Of course, I like a drop of wine, or I don't drink spirits very much. I used to drink a lot of gin and tonics and that kind of stuff, and I don't drink a lot of wine anymore, but I still like a refreshing pint of beer. But then again, I could be different. Now, what do you make of this, Miss Jones, that when Robert Redford was making the film The Way We Were, The Way We Were...
Wonderful song, wasn't it? Great film, wonderful song.
Yeah, so Robert Redford's making that film with Barbara Streisand, who I assume sung the theme music, right? But he's saying in a recent interview that Barbara Streisand was so sort of, what's the word I'm looking at, adventurous, that he always wore two pairs of pants when they were doing the love scenes because he feared that Miss Streisand, you know, would take advantage of him if he was available, if you see what I mean.
Oh, come on. Like, he was such a wimp of a man.
He was married.
He couldn't gently fight her off. Come on. I think that is wishful thinking on his part. I really do.
It says, at the time of filming, he was a happily married 36-year-old father of four, and he didn't want to be subject to, you know, a bit of how's your father.
Well, if he did put more than one pair of pants on, it's more likely that he was afraid of himself becoming aroused in her company.
Oh, Miss Jones, really? You're not very forgiving today, are you?
No, I'm really not.
No, that's right.
What an absolutely ludicrous thing to say.
Well, you know, I mean, I can't speak for him. It's what he said himself.
Yeah. What I would say is pull the other one, but it's a family show.
Oh, Miss Jones, honestly, the innuendo's been getting a bit stronger lately.
Innuendo is an Italian suppository, may I remind you?
Innuendo, yeah, okay.
Innuendo,
yeah, Miss Jones, honestly. Right, now then, you may know this guy. I'm afraid we're back to the old, the land of the not living, and that is a guy called Bruce Gowers. Now, apparently this guy kick-started the era of the pop video, and the first one he made, and one of the most memorable of all time, was Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, this is what they always say, and it always makes me laugh. They say that Bruce Gowers and Bohemian Rhapsody ushered in the video age, enabling, and this is the point, enabling artists to be seen all over the world on television programmes without actually having to go to those countries anymore.
Yeah.
But the Beatles were doing it in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
They filmed promotional films for Strawberry Fields, for example, in Knoll Park, in Sevenoaks.
Yeah.
There were promo films for pop songs way before Bohemian Rhapsody.
Mm.
I think it just became one of those definitive sort of things.
Mm.
But if you unpack it, if you really look at the construction of that video, it's really quite simple. Bruce Gowers made his name doing live television, doing these big TV specials. So for people like Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney and the Stones and Rod and Britney and all those kind of people. And he did American Idol, of course.
Ah.
So that was the real content of his fame. But they always like to date it back and say he invented the rock video when he did Bohemian Rhapsody for Queen. It's utter nonsense.
Yeah.
The pop video had been invented way before that.
Right. That's interesting. I didn't realise that. I thought he was a pathmaker. Now, in addition to my campaign to get myself on Love Island, the middle aged, I'm also ranting and raving on another campaign, and that is, I want to get Mayor Sadiq Khan's ultra low emission zones to be scrapped altogether. He's trying to spread them right across London. People are going to go out of business. It's cost £3,000 a year if you've got an old car, or you pay a daily fee of £12.50 to drive in Greater London, because Mayor Sadiq Khan has ordered you now to get rid of your car if it's old or not suitable. And honestly, it's a power crazed, mad policy which is going to put loads of people out of work.
I actually signed a petition yesterday to get rid of Sadiq Khan.
Oh, well done. Well done. Where was that?
I'll send it to you. A friend of mine sent it to me. Oh, it's one of these official things. And yes, if they get enough signatures, it gets raised in the House of Commons, doesn't it? And if they get over a certain number, over 100,000 or something, they have to raise it seriously as a potential thing.
Yeah.
So I will send you
the
link, and you can sign it as well.
Brilliant. I will do that. Yeah, just to explain to our millions of listeners, Sadiq Khan says this is to keep the air cleaner in London. The air is very clean in London anyway. And in the areas where it now exists, it's made a minimal difference to the quality of the air. But he's got a big black hole in his budget, and he's going to charge, in addition to £15 that you already pay for, you know, the congestion charge to drive into London, you will now pay another £12.50 if your car doesn't measure up to his standards, i.e., in some cases, it's more than 3 years old. And so it's going to cost you, if you work every day, 5 days a week, you know, it's going to cost you £3,000 a year. It's madness. You know, white van man, the plumbers, the, you know, the plasterers, the gardeners, the you know, the guy who runs sandwich shops and all that, they're going out of business. So he's got to go. And on that subject, it's time for us now to go. So to everybody, thank you very much indeed for listening. And we'll be back with you on Planet Porky, this time next week.
Can I tell you now, there is no way I would get my bits out on such a programme for the titillation of the nation.
Yes.
Nobody is that desperate.
I don't think you'd have to get your bits out. I think it'd be a bit more modest than that, as people are middle-aged.
Well, they expect you to put on a bikini and sit around a pool and strut your stuff and all that kind of thing. I can think of nothing more gross. Nobody needs to see that.
Yes. Yeah, well, okay, you say that. Now, I've got the opposite point of view. I think I would be the star of that show, okay? In fact,
I think you probably would, actually. Well, thinking about it.
There you go. You know, I'd be the star of that show. I'd be, you know, erudite and witty and informative and all that kind of stuff.
And you would actually strip off.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I have no...
Down to your shorts.
Well, if I were to go swimming these days, you wear long baggy shorts, you know, so it's not a problem. And I would always wear some kind of short sleeve shirt, because the sun gets me if I don't. So I'd be quite well covered up for medical reasons.
Well, if he did put more than one pair of pants on, it's more likely that he was afraid of himself becoming aroused in her company.
Oh, Miss Jones, really, you're not very forgiving today, are you?
No, I'm really not.
No, that's right.
What an absolutely ludicrous thing to say. Her trick was making truly ugly men believe that they were wildly attractive. And I just laughed so much when I read that, because that's what so many women do.
Yeah.